Good day, everyone, and welcome to the National Immigration Forum call on the refugee ceiling. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one keys on your telephone keypad. In the interest of time, please note to ask one question and to re-queue if you have any follow-ups. Please note that today's call may be recorded, and I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn today's conference over to Jacinta Ma, Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at the National Immigration Forum. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for joining this morning's call on the annual refugee ceiling. By law, the Trump administration must consult with Congress before the end of this fiscal year, which is tomorrow, on setting a number of refugees to admit for the next year. There are concerns that the administration may delay their announcement of the refugee admission ceiling indefinitely, or may even zero out refugee resettlement entirely. Under the Trump administration, refugee admissions have reached historic lows, and from March 18th until July 29th of this year, all refugee admissions to the United States were halted during the COVID-19 pandemic. So only about 10,200 new refugees have been resettled in the country this fiscal year. This is down from about 30,000 last year. And since the refugee admissions program began, the average refugee admissions has been about 95,000. And we have successfully resettled over 3 million refugees over the lifetime of the program. I'm pleased to welcome today's four speakers who will address the growing problems with refugee admissions under the Trump administration, especially during the coronavirus pandemic. They'll underscore the importance of refugee resettlement to our nation. With us on the call this morning are Chris Pilecki, President and CEO of the Bethany Christian Services, Ashley Feasley, Director of Policy and Public Affairs for the Migration and Refugee Services at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Gideon Maltz, Executive Director of the Tent Partnership for Refugees, and Elizabeth Newman, former Assistant Secretary of Counterterrorism and Threat Prevention at the Department of Homeland Security during the Trump administration. We'll begin with Chris Pilecki. Chris, please go ahead.
Great. Thank you so much. Good morning, everybody. I'm Chris Pilecki, the President and CEO of Bethany Christian Services. I spent my entire career working with humanitarian groups to address global crises, and I've never seen crises such on the scale and urgency as we see right now. It's vital that the U.S. commit to resettling more refugees in 2021. Bethany has served refugees and immigrants for 45 years. If the reports are true that refugee resettlement may be zeroed out in fiscal year 2021, it'll be the first year since the 1970s that Bethany has not been able to resettle refugees. So we're urging the administration to return to its historic average of resettling roughly 95,000 refugees in 2021. The Refugee Act of 1980 requires that the president consult with Congress and sign the president determination by October 1st. Neither of these have happened, and America's laws are not merely suggestions. So COVID-19 has already made refugees vulnerable. And those are who are overwhelmingly women and children. And in 2019, less than 1% of the world's refugees were resettled. And I especially want to point out the impact of eliminating resettlement as an option for unaccompanied refugee children. These are just kids. So these are kids who live alone in refugee camps around the world. Their only hope for a safe future is to resettle in a loving foster home in the U.S. Also, amid the pandemic, we have seen refugees rise to the occasion to help communities fight coronavirus. About 176,000 medical workers initially came to the U.S. as refugees, and another 175,000 work in vital supply chains. A great example is a guy named Ibrahim Isak. He's a refugee who was resettled by Bethany, and he makes up about 100 face masks per day for healthcare workers in the U.S. His story is just one of many. And as Christians, as a Christian organization, our faith calls us to welcome the stranger and love our neighbors. We live out our faith by partnering with hundreds of churches who help refugees in our communities thrive, not just survive, but really thrive. Bethany remains committed to demonstrating the love of Jesus by working to ensure the safety and vulnerable children, refugees, and families around the world, especially during this pandemic. Unfortunately, currently the U.S. is choosing to look away from of the suffering and that we could alleviate. And we really believe it's a black eye on our history. So today, Bethany is launching a new report called The Global Refugee Crisis, which details how COVID-19 pandemic has complicated the stressors displaced children and families face. You can see it by looking at Bethany.org. So there are American nonprofits that specialize in resettling, and we have the capability to safely resettle thousands more refugees. So today, we are urging the administration to let us to do that. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Chris. We appreciate your being here with us today. Next, we'll turn to Ashley Feasley, Director of Policy and Public Affairs at the Migration and Refugee Services at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Ashley?
Thank you, Jacinta, and good morning. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops believes it's our duty to protect the life and dignity of all people, regardless of where they were born. The Catholic Church, through the bishops and its Catholic Charities Network, has resettled over 1 million refugees to the United States since the beginning of the formal refugee resettlement system. For decades, the U.S. has been a global leader in refugee resettlement, providing freedom and opportunity to those fleeing persecution while setting an example for other countries around the world. A particular concern relating to where we find ourselves with refugees is the large number of people escaping religious persecution who will undoubtedly be hurt if the administration does not issue a presidential determination and continue to accept refugees. For example, a number of Iraqi Christians resettled declined 94.2% from fiscal year 2016 to 2019, from 1,524 individuals to only 89 people who were escaping religious persecution in Iraq and Christian were allowed to come last year. Similarly, the number of Jewish refugees resettled from Iran declined 97.2% from 2016 to 2019, from 72 individuals to only 2 individuals last year. People fleeing violence and persecution do not pose a threat. We urge the president to issue a presidential determination and continue our commitment to welcoming refugees. 5 years ago, on his apostolic visit to the United States, our Holy Father, Pope Francis, addressed Congress noting, "Let us remember the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them done to you. The yardstick we use for others will be the yardstick which time will use for us." In the same spirit, we urge you to continue to offer welcome to refugees to our country at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. Next, we'll have Gideon Maltz, Executive Director of the Tent Partnership for Refugees. Go ahead, Gideon.
Thank you, Jacinta, and good morning, everyone. The Tent Partnership for Refugees is a coalition of more than 100 large companies committed to integrating refugees into their new communities. The companies in our coalition hire refugees, work with refugee entrepreneurs and small businesses, and extend commercial services to refugees. While the principal reasons for the U.S. to resettle refugees are firstly humanitarian and secondly strategic in the sense that it advances U.S. national interests around the world, there are also very clear economic benefits for businesses and communities across the United States. Refugees are some of the most hardworking, resilient, and dedicated workers, and they make an outsized contribution to the American economy. Refugees are also more likely to be entrepreneurial. One study found that a refugee was about 40% more likely to start a business than a native-born American. Over the last few months, we have seen refugees on the front lines of the effort to keep our communities healthy and safe. Just to give a couple of examples, Dr. Haval, a Kurdish refugee from Syria, is a cardiologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and has been working at a COVID-19 drive-through testing site. Semu, a refugee from Liberia, is an intensive care nurse at a hospital in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, where she's been caring for COVID-19 patients. Iyasu, a refugee from East Africa, is a production supervisor at Chobani's factory in Twin Falls, Idaho, and he's an integral part of the team that's been working overdrive to make yogurt. Adena, also a refugee from Liberia, owns a number of IHOP franchises in New Jersey and has been donating free meals in the community. There are thousands and thousands more like them, serving essential roles that are vital to our communities. We are so much better off to have them in our community and in our economy, and it would be extraordinarily short-sighted to stop the next Dr. Haval, the next Semu, the next Iyasu, and the next Adena from finding safe haven in our country. And I want to emphasize that even today, in an economic downturn with many Americans out of work, it's essential to understand that our economy will only be harmed further if we turn away motivated and hardworking refugees that are ready to contribute. In short, further reductions to the refugee ceiling or an elimination of refugee admissions altogether will not only hurt refugees, it will hurt American businesses and American communities. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Gideon. And our final speaker for today before we take questions is Elizabeth Newman, former Assistant Secretary of Counterterrorism and Threat Prevention at the Department of Homeland Security. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's an honor to join the other three speakers who are doing remarkable work to care for refugees in our country and around the world. I'm pleased to be able to share my perspective during my roles at the Department of Homeland Security, both as Deputy Chief of Staff and the Assistant Secretary for Counterterrorism and Threat Prevention. I participated in the processes that were used to enhance the vetting of refugees, as well as the annual ceiling discussions. In my view, as a Christian and as a conservative and as a national security expert, the administration's approach to immigration fails to uphold our values or keep us safe. Let me be more specific. During my tenure, we assessed our counterterrorism efforts since 9/11. And one of the things that we found is that there are more terrorists in the world today than there were on September 10th, 2001. So while we've prevented another catastrophic attack in the United States by taking the fight to terrorists, we have to acknowledge that we're not winning if we have more terrorists today than we did 20 years ago. Part of the thing that we all realized in the CT community is that we needed to continue working on root causes that lead to radicalization or recruitment to terrorism, that we needed to focus on preventing that radicalization process. A number of the U.S. Tools, diplomatic tools, are used to help address that prevention effort, but in the Trump administration, many of those tools have been removed, which is very unfortunate because it creates the likelihood that we're actually radicalizing more people in this tenure as opposed to in the previous decade. During my tenure, I visited the refugee processing centers in Egypt, as well as the Greek island of Chios, where they processed a surge of refugees coming in from Syria back in 2015 to 2017 timeframe. I came away with a couple of conclusions. One, refugees are the most thoroughly vetted populations that are admitted to the United States. So let me repeat that. They are the most thoroughly vetted populations that are admitted to the United States. We do more work as a U.S. government to interview and look into the backgrounds of refugees than any other population. Now, this is necessary from a security standpoint because often refugees lack typical paperwork or government records because of the nature of the country that they're coming from. Often the government has fallen or can't be trusted. So it's important that we do that vetting, but it is also important for the American public to understand that they are very thoroughly vetted. Second, a number of the enhancements that we made to the vetting process were started in the Obama administration and carried into the Trump administration. And those enhancements are for the most part implemented. There are a handful of technology-related efforts that are underway that will speed up increase the speed by which refugees are processed, but the actual vetting itself is about the same as we will see in years to come. We'll just be able to go faster. So in my viewpoint, by 2019, when we were having conversations about the ceiling, the security and operational needs no longer dictated the need for a lower ceiling. But what you saw last year, it was the opposite. You actually saw the ceiling drop from 30,000 to 18,000. Previous years, when we had had a reduced ceiling, the argument that had been made, which I thought was somewhat justified, was one of we are making enhancements to the security processes and we operationally cannot process any more than these from a security vetting perspective. Therefore, we didn't want to send a signal that more could come in than we could process from that security standpoint. That is no longer the limiting factor. So to see the ceiling go from 30,000 to 18,000 last year convinced me that the administration's approach to refugees was not based on security. In fact, it has to do with a larger effort to just keep out the stranger, to keep out others from around the globe from coming to the United States. The last point I wanted to make, based on my experience looking at the processing centers in Egypt and the Greek island of Chios, delaying the processing of refugees, which in fairness is a worldwide global problem. The delays in processing sometimes are 5 to 10 years from the time that a refugee is identified to the time that they're resettled. That is not just a U.S. challenge, it's a global challenge. But that delay of processing is increasing the root causes that lead to radicalization and potentially creating more terrorists. So from a counterterrorism perspective, how we quickly help a refugee is extremely important to addressing some of those root causes that I referenced at the beginning. So let me close by saying, from a national security perspective, closing the door to refugees does not benefit the United States. Taking in refugees helps our strategic interests and allows us to lead by example, championing democracy and freedom and signaling to people in oppressive regimes that the U.S. is a friend. An administration seeking to keep out others is inherently at odds with my values as an American and as a Christian. Thanks for having me on the call.
Thanks so much, Elizabeth. Now we'll turn to the question and answer portion of the call. Operator, can you please explain to the media on the line how to queue for questions?
Yes. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and one keys on your telephone keypad. You may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Please note that in the interest of time and the number of reporters we have on the line, please limit yourself to one question, and if you have a follow-up, please re-queue. Again, it is star and one to ask a question today. And we will pause for a moment to allow questions to queue.
While we're allowing media to queue, let me just thank all of our speakers so much for your insights. I think I'll take the moderator's prerogative of asking a question. So, you know, this last fiscal year, the refugee ceiling was divided into, like, a number of different kinds of categories for refugees. You know, there was one for religious persecution, Iraqis, the Northern Triangle countries, and then just the other catch-all category. I was just kind of wondering if you had insights on, you know, how did these categories work this year? Were some of the categories filled, some used less than others? You know, generally, you know, are these categories, is having categories a good idea? So, you know, if you could give President Trump some advice, what would you tell him about, you know, setting categories? Is it a good idea or not?
So this is Ashley. I can start. Last year was the first year that the administration changed the traditional categories, which have been done by regional area of international need. So we used to have different allocations based on what part of the world was seeing true global conflict and displacement. As you mentioned, Jacinta, this past year, the president changed the categories into four, one for Central Americans, that was about 1,500 spots, one for religious persecuted individuals and minorities, one for a category known as P2, Iraqis, which was having to do with consular engagement, and then the general catch-all. The two categories that have been most utilized in this fiscal year have been the religious minority and the catch-all, which is about 7,500. Neither one of these categories have been filled for the year, but they are far and away the closest to being, filled. The Central American and the P2 category are quite low. At this point in time, I believe for the P2 category, we have resettled about 10 people in that area, and I can get that stat for you. But, it's a radical rechanging as to how we look to resettle, not really so much looking at global need and protection around the world, but instead looking at America's geopolitical interest. Again, I think it's very important to understand that it is a real change from being responsive to some of the things Elizabeth said about looking at not only protection needs, but also security and other kind of diplomatic reasons, which are other reasons why, you know, resettlement is such a valuable tool.
Thanks, Ashley. Anybody else before we turn to questions? All right, why don't we go to reporter questions then?
We'll take our first question from Sandra Sanchez with BorderReport.com. Please go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to ask historically if, compared to other years, is this the latest that the ceiling has ever been set or not set by an administration? Have they ever let it go this late? And then I wanted to follow up on that last answer, if you could enumerate the four categories and exactly what those ceilings were set at, the 1,500 for Central Americans and the 7,500 for catch-all, if you could fill in the last two. Thank you.
Ashley, do you think you could take this?
Yeah, so I can start, and I'm sure others have things to say. So this would not be the first time that the presidential determination was not reached by the end of the fiscal year. And prior years of the Trump administration, I believe last year, it was not reached signed as required by the statute. So, but I think what's very concerning about the circumstance here is what is required under law is the consultation with Congress. The president and his staff, the administration, must consult with the House and Senate judiciary chairs and ranking members to go through their recommendations, and that has not occurred at this point in time. And so obviously, if we're at tomorrow to do, you know, when the presidential determination is supposed to happen, that's a concern. The numbers for the 1,800, it is, as I mentioned, it's the 7,500 for the catch-all category, so it has no particular different category, and then 5,500 for the religious minorities that we mentioned facing persecution, 1,500 for the Central Americans, and then the remainder is for the P2 Iraqi category.
And just to note on top of that, so this is Chris from Bethany, just a little over 10,000 of those that have actually been resettled, and we've just seen things come to a crawl. So not always alarmed at the number, but even achieving that 18,000, it seems like a challenge.
Then we'll take our next
question.
Sorry, we'll take our next question from Julie Watson with the Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Yes, I was wondering two things, I guess. What will happen if the Trump administration does delay indefinitely its announcement or its determination? And are there penalties or anything under the law that state what will happen? And also, what will the resettlement agencies be doing to respond if there's no number that's being set?
Chris, do you want to take this one?
Sorry?
Chris, could you answer this one?
Sure. So there's no penalties. And that's I think, why we're on a call like this today, that we have such great concern that, you know, there hasn't been a consultation with Congress. It hasn't been signed. It seems that it's not on anybody's priority list right now. And we see families that are staying separated. So it's hurting people, it's keeping families separated, and we're not seeing any action on it, and there is no penalty at this time.
And then just to follow up with what Chris is saying, this is Ashley Feasley, if the presidential determination is not signed, there will not be allowed any refugees to come to the United States. And so, obviously, that is a huge issue for the refugees themselves. and for their families who have been waiting, for individuals who have gone through the process that Elizabeth noted is quite detailed and perhaps will be prevented from actually moving forward if a presidential determination is signed. I did want to take a second for the earlier question about the number of refugees. I had mentioned the categories, and I'm sorry, but it's 5,000 individuals for the religious persecuted. It's not 5,500.
This is Elizabeth. I'm going to add just two more notes to this. One, last year, the presidential determination was issued on November 1st. The consultation with Congress did occur before September 30th, but it was not issued until November 1st. My experience watching the process, the slowdown was not on the people within the system that usually put together the report. They start that process in May or June. There was policy meetings held at my level in the appropriate amount of time. So the only explanation for it being delayed is that they did not view it as a priority and did not get it signed until November 1st, that they haven't done a consultation with Congress yet further sends a signal to me that they're not planning on doing anything anytime soon. The other piece I was going to kind of comment on related to the penalties, and everybody's correct that there's no penalty, but I will say that and certainly the harm is on the refugees, those are who are in queue ready to depart and come to the United States. On October 1st, nobody can come, so it kind of shuts the whole system down. Which, of course, there's any number of people overseas and domestically whose jobs are associated with helping refugees. So you're affecting them. That means funds aren't getting paid to the organizations that are processing and helping these refugees resettled. But the other thing that it does is it really hurts the morale of the employees at the refugee office within USCIS. I understand that. For the last few years, it's been very low morale because they've seen the ceiling numbers drop and they've been asked to do more associated with the asylee category, which is the Trump administration has made an argument that asylees are like refugees. It's just that they're already here in the United States. There's a big difference in the way in which a person who joins USCIS and applies to become a refugee, a part of the refugee program, and a person who applies and works in the asylee program. In particular, your location is very different, right? You're usually at near the southern border where the bulk of the asylees are located, and your refugee processing usually happens overseas. But it's just a different type of work. It's a different set of laws, and what we've found is that we've created quite the brain drain of personnel who are frustrated and disappointed that the thing that they were hired to do, they're not allowed to do. And so one of the consequences of further delaying the ceiling being set is that those folks will not have any work to do, and they are passionate about their mission, and it further creates a morale problem that will take quite a long time to recover from because hiring in the federal government takes so long. It's not like you can flip a switch and bring all of those employees back on super quickly. It will take some time to recover from what has happened over the last few years.
Thanks. And if I could just add a point on that.
Go
sorry.
Ahead,
There's the frustration also, I know, with the folks who are trying to help out, and of course with the refugees. And just to clarify that families will be separated, we had one person who works for us, he's been separated. He had been separated from his family for 2 years. His kids didn't recognize him when they arrived, and it was like a glimmer of light to actually see them reunified. But there are so many people stuck in the same situation. So if the pipeline is cut, these families cannot be reunified. And I think that's the shock that we're really concerned about.
I think we're ready for the next question.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question today, please press the star and one keys on your telephone keypad. We'll take our next question from Connor Finnegan with ABC News. Please go ahead.
Hey, thank you for holding the call. I wanted to put what I anticipate the administration's arguments to be to you all. First, can you talk about what processing refugees go through right now before being resettled in terms of health screenings given the pandemic? And then second, there's been some reporting that the administration may also blame the ongoing litigation over last year's executive. Would you just respond to that? Is that a legitimate reason to delay further reprocessing? Further processing of refugees. Thank you.
Elizabeth, could you take this?
I don't know that I can speak to the health screening. That might be better for some of the other folks on the call.
Okay. Ashley or Chris, would one of you like to talk about that?
Ashley, you want to start it off, and I'll be happy to add.
Sure. So, you know, I think all agencies that are looking to provide care for individuals who are coming in have heightened their health screenings. I know that we, as a resettlement service provider, have been in touch with the State Department and Health and Human Services, both of the governmental offices that we work on, to be responsive to the needs as it relates to the health screening and vetting. But I will just say to you that, and Elizabeth and Chris can both add to this, refugees already undergo extensive vetting, both in the security and the health kind of pre-screening and check. And so additional measures that have been implemented are, you know, on top of what is already occurring. I think it's also important to understand that we didn't have, except in very rare cases of exceptional need, refugees coming in for the past several months. So there has been a real concern and a real noted, I think, effort to be aware of any sort of health concerns. I know from our programmatic level, I'm not a resettlement, direct service provider, but we constantly have engagement with our service providers about the need for PPE, the need for testing, the need for, you know, social distancing and other things. I'm happy to get back to you on the explicit procedures. I will kick the question over to Chris, but I did just want to answer quickly about the litigation. It's my understanding that there is an oral argument that will be placed for the end of October for the litigation, USCCB is not one of the litigants, but, it is about the executive order 130888 that was used for state and local consent for refugee resettlement. At the time that the preliminary injunction, the litigation began and the preliminary injunction was sought in late January, early February, we had all but five states who had responded, and all but one of those 42 or 43 states had consented. There are two or three states that don't do refugee resettlement, and so they are not in the calculation. But, like I said, every state who had actually moved forward in the process and issued a decision had consented but for Texas. So I think, as it relates to the ongoing litigation, I think actually it's been a vote of support from the state and local level on resettlement that I know we were pleasantly surprised about. And as for the outstanding five states had not yet issued a decision but were still within kind of the deadline that the State Department had given, I don't know what their decision is, but I know that a bunch of us were working on the ground to engage them. I think it is important thinking about the litigation that, there was a clear groundswell of support for refugees at the state and local level that, I think we will work to replicate even if an executive order is, instituted again.
Yeah, and just maybe a little more on the the technical side. So we work with the Bureau of Population Migration for Refugees, and they have these guidelines, and they screen refugees before they arrive and after they arrive. And then they actually have a two-week quarantine. So agencies like Bethany's, we help provide a safe space, making sure that they're monitored during this quarantine period. And the CDC, they have put together guidelines on how to safely resettle refugees during a pandemic. So it's in our report that we're putting out today. So again, I'd encourage folks to go to bethany.org and check it out. But there are safe ways to do this, and we've been doing it, and it's possible. And thanks for bringing up the litigation, because we believe the ongoing litigation does not give the administration permission to ignore the Refugee Act. It's so important, and it was great to see it was actually supported by both sides of the aisle, that there were a lot of Democrat and Republican governors who wanted to continue to welcome refugees, and we'd like to see more of that.
Great. Operator, are there any other questions in the queue?
And there are no further questions on the line at this time. I'll turn the program to Jacinta for any closing remarks.
All right. Thank you so much. Again, I wanted to thank our speakers so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And have a good day, everybody.